from remote lakes, streams, and stagnant ponds.
Get the Advanced Berkey Light Purifier for only $279 by calling New Millennium, 888-803-4438, or order on the web at berkeywater.com. Not yet available in Iowa.
This is the GCN Radio Network, home to hard-hitting talk radio.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and well, of course, for this next hour, it's going to be an interesting program. We're supposed to have with us for the first half hour William Grigg, who's certainly one of our regular speakers, but he's going to be talking about communitarianism. And then at the half hour, we're going to, of course, go to Senator Beeson, who is a legislator, and he's going to be talking about communitarianism. But without further ado, let's go to William here. Hi, William. Thank you so very much for being with us on short notice. I'm doing just fine, thanks. Well, I'm just so glad that you're there, because if I was going to talk on communitarianism for half an hour, why, we'd be playing music for about 25 minutes. So why don't you pick up the story? Most people do not understand what communitarianism is, why it is wrong, and how it is the antithesis of our form of government and our way of life. What is communitarianism, and what is it? How is it being encouraged and facilitated here in America today?
You used a very interesting and significant expression when you used the word antithesis, because that, of course, is one of the terms of what's called the dialectic. That's a process of reasoning. You start with a thesis, which is the statement of a principle or a position, and then that generates what is called an antithesis, which is the opposite of that statement or position. And then the two of these interact, and from this comes a synthesis. For instance, you could say that you could take black and white together, and white would be the thesis, black would be the antithesis, and the synthesis would be gray. And a lot of secular philosophers, most notably George Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel, have used the dialectic to describe the process whereby human communities, human society in general, supposedly evolves. That there is a thesis that is stated in one age, it generates an antithesis, and that from these two, from the collision of these two, you have a synthesis of the two of them. So communitarianism really should be considered, if you will, the political synthesis of the Western view of individual liberty under law and the Marxist view of the collective. And so you have some elements of the Western point of view, colored by some elements of the collectivist point of view espoused by Marx and others. And the synthesis of these two is a system where you talk about rights plus responsibilities, and the government is in charge of defining both the rights and the responsibilities of the individual, and it is in that part of this whole proposition that the devil resides. The government is not supposed to be in the business of defining rights. Our rights inhere in us as a gift of our Creator. And that, of course, underscores the basic point here. We're talking about secular philosophies, which is to say humanist or godless philosophies of government. They will make operative or operational use of religious concepts to advance this agenda, but all the religious concepts are circumscribed by this understanding that really man is the measure of all things, and that man acting in the name of the collective is the most powerful and most formidable entity before whom we must genuflect. This is a concept that is wholly totalitarian. There is no limit to government power under this scenario, and there is nothing by way of permanent established individual rights either.
I think it's important people understand there are two basic philosophies. One, of course, is talking about man being free under God. And, of course, man shouldn't be subservient to God, not to government. And then there's the other totalitarian regime that says there is no God and we're going to have a better society. We're going to have an all-powerful state and an all-powerful ruler who is going to control the people, because people cannot look after themselves. There would be chaos. And so we must, of course, have, you know, an authoritarian society to keep people from destroying themselves. We'll be back in just a moment here with William Grigg, right here at Radio Liberty.
Well, this is Pastor David Whitney with Institute on the Constitution. Our founders constructed this constitutional republic with the intent that citizens would function as the final check on the power of civil government. But that design would only work if the citizens understood our form of government as well as their responsibilities within that structure. That's why Institute on the Constitution has put together a host kit that enables anyone, anywhere, with any group of people to instruct them on our founding documents. We urge you to order a host kit. You can call us toll free at 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or you can order it on the web. Go to our website, iotconline.com. The only way our republic will survive is if its citizens arm themselves with the knowledge of our founding fathers' original intent of the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights. Call us, 866-730-9796.
It's a fact. Since the creation of the Federal Reserve in 1913, all banks in these United States create money out of thin air for every single loan they issue. With never-ending late fees, over-the-limit fees, and higher interest rates, it has become mathematically impossible to repay all debt, making all of us slaves to our creditors. The Federal Debt Relief System has created a successful attorney-backed program to legally eliminate credit card debt, personal loans, lines of credit, and other unsecured debts which have been fraudulently created by the banks. We can terminate your unsecured debt within 18 months with a much lower monthly payment, ending with nothing on your credit report. Join the thousands of Americans who now breathe with a sigh of relief because they have legally eliminated their debt. Instead of living each day in fear and frustration, it's time to take action and turn your life around. Call the Federal Debt Relief System at 877-943-8600. That's 877-943-8600. Or visit FDRS.org. Find out how you can break the cycle of debt slavery. Visit FDRS.org today.
Did you know that pH balance is one of the most important factors in maintaining high energy and vibrant health? Most experts agree that the water you drink should be at a pH level of 9 or higher. Plasma pH Drops combine a unique formula of the most alkaline minerals and elements. This product is a one-of-a-kind in its strength and effectiveness. Using plasma pH drops is one of the best ways to make your water alkaline while helping you get rid of acid and regaining your health and energy. With just 10 drops, you can raise the pH level of the water you drink up to the pH of 10. Alkalizing water helps the body rid itself of acidic waste and increases the oxygen content of your body. Disease organisms like bacteria and cancer cannot survive in an alkaline environment. Order your bottle of AlkaVision Plasma pH Drops now by going directly to AlkaVision.com. That's A-L-K-A-Vision.com. Or call 269-344-3420 today.
Let's talk for just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this afternoon, of course, is William Grigg. He's talking about communitarianism, this philosophy, which is really the underlying philosophy behind Marxism and socialism and humanism. This idea that we need an all-powerful state to take care of the people because they can't take care of themselves. That is the antithesis of the American idea of limited government under God. And unfortunately, communitarianism is the philosophy that's being taught in our colleges. This is what's being taught in our schools. Our children are being indoctrinated in this idea to look to the state as the mediator on all affairs, to believe that we are a democracy when we're not a democracy or a republic. But it doesn't matter how ridiculous something is, if you say it often enough, and repeat it often enough, and the president says it, and the politicians say it, and the teachers say it, and the media says it, eventually people come to believe we are a democracy, and whatever the majority wants is perfectly all right. And that is the antithesis of our form of government, where the power of the state was to be limited eternally by the change of the Constitution, and we were to be a republic and not a democracy. So pick this story up there, William.
You brushed up against one of the really important defining characteristics of the communitarian worldview, which is the repudiation of the idea of permanent, fixed, if you will, canonical laws. The American concept is that government has to be chained by the Constitution. Those chains are supposed to be adamantine. They're supposed to be unbreakable. They're supposed to be rooted in something more permanent than the Caucasus Mountains. And one of the reasons why communitarianism is so insidious is that it talks about participation by stakeholders, that's a common expression you hear in communitarian circles, in the creation of a consensus. And the consensus, of course, consists of something that is essentially dictated by society's supervisors and then ratified by stakeholders supposedly representing all of a given community. And that consensus will shift. It will tend to be protean rather than permanent. It's something that will reflect whatever objective society's supervisors have for a given community. And because it's subject to change without notice, you can't have permanent laws that limit what the state can do. In some circumstances, the state may be permitted to kill people indiscriminately. In other circumstances, the state is forbidden to kill people without certain exceptions, and without certain conditions being met. But the point is, there's no permanent fixed standard, like the Ten Commandments simply says, thou shalt do no murder. The consensus may change under the communitarian worldview to be more suitable for the needs of a given ruling elite. There's a book that's tremendously useful to understand the communitarian worldview. It's a very slender book. It came out about 18 years ago. It was published by George C. Lodge, and the book was entitled Managing Globalization in the Age of Interdependence. And Mr. Lodge talked about communitarianism as sort of this third-way ideology that was really in vogue in the late 90s and early years of this century, particularly over in Tony Blair's England. And Bill Clinton also talked about this third way between socialism and capitalism, supposedly. But Lodge says is the following. The communitarian may or may not value democracy, regarding it as only one way of defining community need. Individualism argues for a voluntary consensus. The communitarian believes that it may be necessary to secure consensus through coercion, as in prisons. And he lists a number of communitarian leaders who are by no means what we would consider to be benign. For instance, he says, and I'm quoting, there is nothing inherently good or bad about communitarianism. No ideology has a monopoly on sin or virtue. Stalin and Hitler were communitarians, as are Lee Kuan Yew, who was the then dictator of the city-state of Singapore, and the leaders of Japan and Israel. Even, it seems to me, Bill Clinton is a communitarian. In other words, anybody who believes in the unbridled power of the government to shape a consensus and to impose that consensus on a population in the name of the collective is a communitarian. And the spectrum runs from people who are supposedly benign as Lee Kuan Yew through Bill Clinton all the way out to people like Stalin and Hitler who killed tens of millions. And so because communitarianism has no fixed points of reference in permanent morality, and everything is defined by the rulers of a given communitarian order in the name of the collective, as they see fit, there are no permanent refuges for individual rights.
And, you know, I think the significant thing is that most people don't understand that there really are people who want power. There have always been people who wanted power over the others. They wanted to be the feudal lords. They wanted to be the emperor. They wanted to be the king. They wanted to be the dictator. And, of course, they want to be the dictator here in the United States. Mankind's ideas have not changed. Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely everyone. And men want power. And with that, all the advantages that come. People don't understand. We have those same people working in Washington, D.C. today that our founding fathers feared. The reason they wrote the Constitution as they did and required people to swear allegiance to it was because they knew that there were people out there who wanted power, and the whole idea of the Constitution was to take the chains off of the people and put the chains on government, and in a free society, people would have the right to succeed or to fail. But government, it was never the function of the federal government, the centralized government, to look after them. That was the function of the local community and local individuals and churches. Nobody ever starved in our church, and nobody ever went without medical care in our free society. But, of course, they had to convince us how terrible it was before they could change it and move us from freedom towards communitarianism. Would that be a fair appraisal?
I think that's a fair appraisal, and it's important to recognize that really the official ideology of the globalist movement is communitarianism. If you take a look at the way, for instance, that a lot of environmental policies are enacted in this country, a lot of them grow out of this Agenda 21 document that was issued by the United Nations, and the Biodiversity Treaty, which was never ratified by the Senate, but the protocols are being enacted by policymakers in this country. They always gather together a group of stakeholders who supposedly represent a given society, or better stated, a given community, whether you're talking about, for instance, logging communities here in the Pacific Northwest, or whether you're talking about some of the ranching communities in states like Nevada. They assemble these stakeholders, and then they dictate to these stakeholders the proper boundaries for the consensus they're trying to achieve, and then they have people engaging in a controlled, structured dialogue for the purpose of ratifying this preordained consensus, and then it is imposed upon the larger community as if it represents the authentic will of the people in that given community. Now, that's the same kind of decision-making structure that existed in the Soviet Union. They called those entities Soviets. The communitarians do not necessarily call them Soviets, but they function the same way, and the stakeholders acted in pretty much the same way that the delegates to a local Soviet would act back in the days of the Soviet Union. I think pretty much the same way it operates today in post-Soviet Russia. But one of the things that Lodge pointed out in his book, and bear in mind that the book was published in 1995, is the following quote, the most urgent task for diplomacy in the 21st century is the challenge of meshing, not merging, the various national brands of communitarianism to create a legitimate basis for the transnational governmental mechanisms required to manage globalization. He talks about the fact that there are, quote, energetic and creative individuals in government, interest groups, and corporations who are quietly assembling global arrangements to deal with crises and tensions. For the most part, they work outside of legislatures and parliaments and are screened from the glare of the media in order to find common interests, shape a consensus, and persuade those with power to change. Now, the type of people he's talking about, people like you and I would refer to as conspirators, because what they are doing is in the shadows of society, cloaked in secrecy, they are covertly collaborating to change the world in ways that would affect the lives of everybody who lives on this planet. They're doing so through the means of the leverage that exercise over policymakers and national leaders and national rulers, but ultimately what they ordain for society would be imposed on us through coercion. And there are all kinds of United Nations enactments and pronouncements and policy measures that are quietly being implemented that way. You and I have talked, Dr. Stan, on many occasions about the Earth Charter. The Earth Charter is a perfect example of communitarianism in action, and the way that it was created and the way that it was taken around to various communities and made the focal point of something that would have to be considered borderline idolatry, if not outright idolatry, is a really good example of one variety of communitarianism with definite religious overtones.
And I think really, Chris, they even talk there about the spirituality of that, but they're not talking about Christian spirituality,
exactly,
or Jewish spirituality. They're talking about this other spirituality where you come in contact with the other dimension. And the fact that most people have never heard of these things, the fact that most people do not understand there is an organized effort there to destroy our freedom, that these people are very well financed, that these people have tremendous power. They're working at every level of our government, and anybody who ever tries to bring this out is immediately attacked and demonized and accused of being a conspiracy buff. And yet a conspiracy is nothing more than two or three people getting together to try and change the direction of society and doing it in secret. And these people, of course, do what they do in secret. Most people have no idea what's going on because the media in America has been compromised. The media is controlled. 90 to 95% of the major media outlets in the United States are controlled by 5 to 6 major corporations. If you don't believe it, you should read the writings of Ben Bagdakian, a professor at the University of California, who wrote a book in 2003, I think it was, on the new media monopoly. The new media monopoly, which dominates America and makes mockery of the idea of freedom of the press.
Well, you want a really good example of how this works in practice. Take a look at the upcoming, I believe, early September summit on national service that's slated to be held in New York City beginning on the 11th of next month. September 11th, of course, is now a new high holy day in the collectivist calendar. And what they're doing is they're having a huge bipartisan rally to advance the idea that there has to be some kind of dictated, compelled, government-mandated minimum service requirement for the for people of college age. And, of course, that would eventually include some form of military conscription. The thing that I find really interesting here is that this is being sponsored, in large measure, by media outlets. Time Magazine is a major sponsor of this. as are a number of news organizations, and it's not as if they're neutral observers of what's going on. They're trying to use their leverage in terms of image making and mobilizing the masses to bring about these changes in society in the direction of wholesale collectivism. There's nothing more collectivist than conscription, whether you're talking about military conscription or the civilian equivalent. And that's very much part of the whole communitarian package. That's one of the obligations.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, William, go right ahead there.
One of the other things I wanted to talk about here was the way that the Bush administration was so deeply involved in communitarian activism, and how many of the people, particularly in the first Bush term, many of the people who put together the so-called faith-based communities initiative, or the faith-based outreach program, the subsidy program to churches, were involved in communitarian activism of a religious variety. And the inaugural speech, the first inaugural speech by George W. Bush, was very much a communitarian message when he talked about the idea of eschewing sharp partisan distinctions and focusing upon a compassionate agenda where he'd mobilize the government on behalf of compassionate objectives. This is a speech that was vetted among other people, a fellow by the name of Robert D. Putnam, who's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, not surprisingly, who's an outspoken exponent of communitarianism. He's a professor at Harvard, and he was somebody who placed his imprimatur on this. He said, you know, the first Bush inaugural that was written by a number of people, including Michael Gerson, who is one of the chief speechwriters, now as a CFR member is a opinion columnist of the Washington Post. So this is more or less the Republican version of the communitarian worldview. And that speech was also vetted before it was delivered by a fellow by the name of Amtai Etzioni, who is probably the most important and influential of all the communitarian thinkers and activists. He's a quote-unquote former terrorist. He was born and raised in Israel in a Marxist environment. He was not raised as a religious Jew. He was raised as a Marxist. And he has written a number of books that are considered to be more or less standard works of the communitarian movement. And he makes it very plain that once you get past sort of the superficial flavoring of compassion and restraint, and you get into the nuts and bolts of what the movement entails, you're talking about using government power forcibly to change the way people make decisions, with, of course, buttressed by the threat of severe sanctions and penalties, imprisonment and worse, in order to move the entire community more in the direction of a collectivist society.
And that's just exactly what they do in communist China, you know. Mm-hmm. First, if you don't go along with the agenda, why, first, you're going to be sent off to a labor camp. In fact, it was interesting that there were a couple of 71-year-old women, both with canes, who were being sent to labor camps because they objected to the fact that the Chinese government had taken their property and had not compensated mm-hmm. them adequately for it. But nobody thought there was anything wrong. You're not supposed to complain. You're supposed to accept everything. And, of course, if you do complain, why, you need to be re-educated by labor.
Yeah.
And this is the government that the American State Department brought to power back in 1950. Everybody's forgotten that, but it's covered in my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. People have forgotten that back in 1949 and 1950, the United States State Department brought the communists to power in China over the nationalists, who wanted to give the people an element of freedom. Because, of course, our government wanted a great social experiment. It's been a great social experiment. It succeeded wonderfully. We saw how well it succeeded there at the Olympics, where all these people, tens of thousands of people, all moving in unison, exactly as they're directed, or, if you don't, off to the labor camp with you, along with these 71-year-old ladies. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Chris Williams has been talking about this whole philosophy of communitarianism. And what most people don't understand is communitarianism and communism and socialism and humanism are all basically the same. They are the antithesis of Americanism, which says the power of the government should be limited so people can be free. And the communitarian philosophy is the power of government must be expanded so we can have a better society, so we can have true equality, except, of course, for the ruling elite. Yeah. So pick the story up there.
You make a very important point there. I mean, in the Animal Farm sense of the expression, the elite, of course, are more equal than the rest of us. And because they've been endowed by history or the demiurge or whatever impersonal force supposedly propels history to ordain the way that the rest of us will live in the interests of the common good. I mean, that's, once again, this supervisory conceit that you find in every other variety of totalitarianism is very active in communitarianism. The biggest difference, of course, is that really communitarianism focuses on what is called soft law. When you're talking about applying it internationally, there's a really useful book on that subject by Anne Marie Slaughter of the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs. Of course, she's likewise a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, which is a really good example, the CFR itself, of the type of organization that promotes the communitarian movement. Really, if you want to know communitarianism, it's sort of a modern post-1990s updated version of the old Fabian socialist movement, which pursued its objectives through stealth and deception rather than pursuing the communal takeover of society through violence and subversion the way that more orthodox Marxists would pursue it. The Fabian socialists, of course, their symbology includes such striking examples of deception as the wolf in sheep's clothing, and then, of course, their tactical and strategic approaches symbolized by the turtle and tortoise, as in the parable of the tortoise and the hare. But Anne Marie Slaughter has talked about the fact that the way communitarianism is unfolding worldwide is through global policy networks that are not formally subject to the type of checks and balances and institutional ratification that you would find in governmental settings. She talks about such entities as NAFTA, the World Trade Organization, the European Union, various multilateral trade agencies, various multilateral intergovernmental agencies. All of them are making policy, but none of them really are enacting what you would call laws. The World Trade Organization does have a certain judicial or quasi-judicial function where it can impose its rulings and enforce them through trade sanctions. But most of these other organizations simply create these bodies of so-called laws that are acted on by policymakers without having any formal sanction mechanism or enforcement mechanism.
And I think it's important.
Consensus around us.
I think people have to understand it. The whole idea of you will have a bureaucracy that's not answerable to anybody. You will have a ruling bureaucracy that's answerable to the elite. And we will all be subjective to the bureaucratic edicts and decisions that are made.
Mm-hmm.
It is simply a means of centralizing power with the feudal lords. But we can't tell the American people that. They've got to believe, of course, these things are sort of evolving by themselves. Nobody's behind it. Our Constitution is being simply eliminated step by step by step. And anybody who points to this is called, oh, you're an originalist, or you believe in that old-fashioned Constitution. Well, let me tell you, the Constitution, when it was written, was the greatest, most novel document ever written. Everybody in the world recognizes that. Everybody has tried to emulate what we had when, of course, America was created during the early years, and people have forgotten that our government gave liberty because it limited the power of the government, the bureaucracy, over the lives of the people at the federal, at the state, and at the local level. And those lessons have been long since forgotten, haven't they, William?
Yeah, they have. And the thing that I find remarkable is that there is nothing that has happened between 1787 and 2008 that has in any way invalidated any of the insights of the founders. To the contrary, their insights about the danger of emancipating the power of government and placing that power in the hands of fallen men have been fully vindicated, redundantly so. You take a look at the death toll from 20th century totalitarianism being something north of 170 million victims of democide, that is to say systematic mass murder of people by their own governments. That's the sort of thing that the Founding Fathers were warning about. I doubt that they would have imagined it would have gotten that bad. I don't think that they could have imagined a situation where the populations of so many of the nations and kingdoms of the world would permit themselves to be put into the hands of people that had total power over them.
But I think it's so important for people, our listeners, to understand that this democide has been certainly actually ignored totally by our leaders. In fact, they've even encouraged it. David Rockefeller talked about the wonderful social experiment in China after they'd already killed 100 million people. We're going to have to let you go. We're going to have to get Senator Beeson on. But, William, thank you so very much for being with us. We'll look forward to talking to you tomorrow afternoon.
God bless.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Visit GCNlive.com today.
Have you made preparations to look after yourself and your family in case there's a national emergency or a terrorist attack? Well, I want to tell you that the government's looking after their people. In fact, plans have been made to protect people of high-ranking position in government, but they're not making any preparations for the average individual, so you're going to have to look after yourself. If you'd like information on long-term food storage, if you'd like information on the other items you would need in case of a national emergency, why don't you give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927 and ask for the emergency food catalog. We'll get it right off to you and we'll get the items shipped directly from Ready Reserve Foods. That's 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. You're going to have to begin making preparations to look after yourself.
Do you have doubts about the stability of the dollar or your own financial future? Is a dismal growth rate or rampant inflation affecting the bottom line of your retirement savings account? Do you worry about uncontrollable economic events which could suddenly wipe out some or all of your hard-earned savings? You can turn adversity into opportunity. Individual retirement accounts and most 401ks, 403bs, SEFs, and other retirement plans can be rolled over into self-directed accounts using gold and silver. There are definitely some do's and don'ts with this rollover process, and that's where Midas Resources comes in. Call us at 1-866-323-5665, and we can help you with this process. History has shown that metals will maintain your buying power even if other financial assets are failing. It's not a question of if you'll need precious metals in your portfolio, it's a question of when. So whether you're planning for an economic rainy day or a Category 5 hurricane, the solution is the same. Call us today at 1-866-323-5665. 1-866-323-5665.
Since the year 2000, earthquakes, heat waves, droughts, tsunamis, floods, fires, and hurricanes have killed over 1 million people worldwide and forced tens of millions to go without food and water. After Katrina, the media was eager to show victims in New Orleans begging for food. If a disaster strikes you and your loved ones and you have no stored food, you'll be begging as well. Now our economy is slipping into an abyss that even Donald Trump says will make the Great Depression look like a Sunday picnic. The U.S. dollar is worth less today than it was even last week. Before food prices skyrocket, trucks stop running, and stores close their doors, Survival Enterprises can help you prepare. They're master distributors of Mountain House freeze-dried food with up to a 50-year shelf life. Survival Enterprises has real butter, cheese, and bread, real beef, chicken, and turkey, all canned for long-term storage. For their website and more info, call 1-800-753-1981. That's 1-800-753-1981. And remember, if you wait until you need us, it's too late. Call now.
Beeson. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this afternoon for the second half here is Senator Scott Beeson, and he's a state senator. He's ordinarily a businessman, but he's given up his regular profession to be involved in politics to try to preserve these concepts of liberty in America that once made us the envy of the world, and yet step by step in the name of fighting terrorism or fighting poverty or fighting drugs or the war on whatever it would be, the next great war, environmentalism, why we're losing our freedom step by step. Senator Beeson, thank you very much for being with us.
Dr. Stan, I appreciate you having me on. How are you this evening?
I'm doing just fine, thanks. So you go ahead and pick up the story here. Suddenly we were going to be talking about communitarianism, which seems to be sort of an overall description of all of these various totalitarian movements of one degree or another that threatened the survival of freedom in America.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. I listened to you and William speak in the first hour online here on my computer in my office at home, and if I cut out a little bit, it's because we're having some bad weather down here in Alabama. But
No, I couldn't agree more with most of the points that y'all have made. It's really a sad situation that the United States is losing all the freedom, or many freedoms that we've kind of grown accustomed to them, and we take them for granted. And I think we've reached the point where we don't really know what freedom is anymore. And unfortunately, we're allowing people who do understand power and how to accumulate power and how to change governments over a long period of time, we're letting those people work tirelessly to change the kind of worldview that so many Americans have. And fortunately, there's people like you and me and Mr. Grigg who are out there trying to tell people what's going on. And you made a comment about how people just kind of think you're a little bit off, I guess. I think you said an originalist when you were talking about the Constitution, but some people think you're off if you mentioned that these things are going on, the communitarian effort that's involved in these Bible curriculums that are trying to be put into the schools. Now, that's one of the issues that's very near and dear to me, and I'm on the advisory board of the National Council for Bible Curriculum for Schools, and I've spent a lot of time here in the state legislature in Alabama and on the radio around the country kind of trying to bring to light some of the communitarian efforts they're involved in with a group called the Bible Literacy Project. And it's really, in my opinion, a big step in trying to get communitarian philosophy in more into our schools. And to use the Bible to do so is really kind of a heinous ploy.
Well, could you define communitarianism for our listeners who may not be acquainted with the term at all? How does this differ from Americanism?
Well, I thought I'd made up kind of an original thing, and then when I was reading about communitarianism, I guess about a year or so ago, someone else had said it, but I had always called it communism for Christians.
Right,
and
that's a great definition.
Somebody else had said, you know, it's communism for people who believe in God, but it really, to me, I guess in a layman's terms, it would be convincing people that if we all work together and we all just think the same and we're all pulling the same cart, the world will be a beautiful and better place. If there were no conflicts between religions and there were no different sects and everyone kind of thought the same, we would all be at peace and there would be this wonderful Eden-like existence. The problem with those kind of things is it's not worked anywhere in the world. There always has to be someone in charge to tell the masses who are kind of following along blindly what they need to do. And the problem I have with it from a Christian point of view is it really belittles the individuality. I believe every individual was created by God with a special purpose, a special role in life. And I think it really downplays that individualism, which personally I think is one of the things that has made our country the greatest in the world.
I agree with you totally. And that, of course, America was based upon this idea of liberty under God, with the idea that a liberty and limited government were synonymous, and that tyranny and total government were synonymous. And there were only a few things that our government was to do with it. They outlined the Constitution in Article 1, Section 8, and the rest of these powers were not given to the federal government, were to be limited to the states and to the people. But that has been forgotten. They don't teach that in school anymore. They teach us we're a democracy, and whatever our duly elected representatives want is perfectly all right. And yet, of course, the popularity of Congress today is about 9%. How would you possibly give the people that only 9% of the people support the ability to determine the future of our society? People realize the hypocrisy of the Republicans and the Democrats, and it really doesn't seem to matter which party controls the White House. The same foreign and domestic policy continue. How are we going to get people educated, Senator, and understand that freedom is not free, and if they're not involved, then the freedom we've known and enjoyed will soon to become simply a remembrance of things past?
No, you're absolutely right. And one of the things we have to really do, I believe, is do some things in the public school system state legislators, where the last burning flames of states' rights are still alive, at least down in the South they are. And I recently saw an article where Oklahoma had passed a resolution in their state house of representatives basically telling the federal government that they had overstepped their bounds and put them on notice that unless they could show them in the Constitution where the federal government had the power to do these things they were telling the state of Oklahoma to do, they were going to ignore them. Now, some people might say, well, that's a little bit off, but for an entire legislative arm, the House of Representatives in Oklahoma, to do that, that's a pretty big deal, and I think you're starting to see that. But unless we educate folks and unless the young people start to realize what a beautiful document the United States Constitution is, and the threat of totalitarianism and the danger of having a small group of people ruling over everyone else, I think we'll continue down this slippery slope. But we have to be willing to go out and say, this is right, this is wrong, this is Western civilization, this is American culture, and it's based on Christianity. And other people can talk about the value of other cultures, but my opinion is we have to say, this is the best system ever devised. It's the best in the world. We are proud of it. We're going to stand up for it, and we're going to fight for it. And we've got to really stop this, what the political correctness of saying everything is even, everything is the same. It's not. There's a better way to do things, and our way is the better way. We need to be proud of it. The rest of the world tries to emulate us, while at the same time we spend all our energy trying to act like they did.
Well, you know, it's
a crazy thing, but political leaders have just got to get some spine.
Well, you know, the thing that really bothers me is the American people seem to be going along with the administration's war on terrorism here. And, of course, in the name, of course, protecting us from the terrorists, of course, we have to go through special checkpoints to get in the airport and take off our shoes and our belts and our sweaters and submit to personal searches. And the same thing getting into federal buildings. You know, there's certainly very... I find, of course, the government now has been listening to our telephone conversations, and the Congress has voted. It's perfectly all right for them to have violated the law, gave them, you know, a retroactive immunity, AT&T and the other large carriers, for violating the laws. And, of course, they can listen to anybody they want to, and it's all in the name of fighting terrorism. But if there's really a war on terrorism, why haven't they sealed our borders? Any terrorist who wants to could come right across those borders down south. And, of course, certainly if they're really involved in a war on terrorism, why are we financing the Pakistani government that's financing the Taliban that's killing our men over there in Afghanistan? Yeah. Are we really involved in a war on terrorism, or is all of this simply shenanigans so the American people will give up their freedom step by step by step to the communitarians who control both political parties?
Right. Well, I think what it is there's some truth to that, and the risk is, and I'm like every other normal American, I would guess, we just don't want to believe that that's even possible. So we kind of turn a blind eye. You know, most good Americans who believe in the Constitution and godly folks are out there working their jobs, trying to pay the taxes, taking their kids to the ballpark, you know, paying their mortgage, saving up for college, doing all the things that everybody does to live their life, and they just really don't have the time to think about what is going on and to really question. I think that's one of the things the Founding Fathers did a great job of giving us was the idea of questioning government, being skeptical of government. And gradually it looks like we believe what government tells us, and I don't think that's healthy.
Well, tell us a little bit about the Bible literacy program and why that's so important, and how is it being introduced into schools? I thought that they'd pretty well taken any mention of God out of our schools.
Well, that's the interesting thing to understand is for years and years, you know, left-wing liberal groups have kind of all banded together, and they spent a lot of time and money making sure that the Bible was not in public schools at all, and any reference to God or a Christian God was eliminated. Many school systems can't celebrate Christmas. You can't sing Christmas hymns, all the things we all know about. And then just a couple of years ago, there became this resurgence. There was a group called the Bible Literacy Project, and they came up with a textbook called The Bible and Its Influence. And when we first saw it, it came to the before the state legislature in Alabama, I guess it was 3 years ago now. And Alabama, of all places, they come in, they get the majority leader and Speaker of the House in Alabama to sponsor a bill to require, well, to offer studies in Bible. But they make sure that they inflation.
You're sort of cutting out there. Is your telephone getting a little tired there?
Yeah, no one ever called me. somebody at home. So that's just the beeping. What was the last thing y'all had heard?
Well, basically, you said basically what they did was they actually got hold of the majority leader there and in the Senate and the House and got him to introduce legislation. So you pick up the idea from there.
Yes, the majority leader and the Speaker of the House to introduce legislation that actually said if you're going to teach the Bible in Alabama as an elective, you're going to use this one particular book, and it was called The Bible and Its Influence. To give you an idea how people, I don't think anything was on accident. What they did was they went out to people and said, I was opposed to it once I saw the book and I saw what was in it and saw the communitarianism in it and saw the fact that they don't even use the dating system BC and AD. They use common. So they go out and say to people, you know, Senator Benson is opposed to the Bible and its influence in your kids' schools. Well, in Alabama, people want Bible taught. That was titled a certain book political club to hit people with, and that's just the beginning. That's the first time I'd ever been confronted with these folks, and then as I began to study who supported this book, who helped write this book, you learn more and more about the kind of sinister effort that is behind this book. Bible Literacy Project.
All right. You don't have access to a regular telephone, do you, Senator?
Call back if this one's cutting out. We have some bad weather.
All right, fine. I'm going to ask my producer just give you a call back there, and let's see if we can do any
better. Let's try that.
Let's give you one more try, and we'll get our producer to call back. But basically, there's a move, certainly in the South, to have the Bible taught in school as literature. In other words, basically, it is one of the greatest things ever written. And the whole I'm going to ask my producer if she would go ahead and call the senator back again and see if we get a better line. But certainly, so this was really taking hold back there, and they were in many of the schools teaching the Bible as literature. And of course, the one thing that the enemies of freedom hate is the Christian message or the Judeo-Christian message. So they came back with this idea that you're going to have to use our textbook, and our textbook is going to, is going to sort of talk about Christianity, but not really about Christianity. It's going to be undermining Christianity, and it's going to be these basic ideas of communitarianism. And, of course, we're all going to get together, not under God, but we're all going to get together, and the state is going to become all-powerful, and the state is going to then make a better world. And of course, these ideas are so subtle. They're so clever. They know exactly what they're doing. They have unlimited funds. Who is behind this? Well, the great tax-exempt foundations, in part. And we're talking about Rockefeller and Ford and Pew and Carnegie and all of these great foundations that are doing everything they can to alter America. And you must understand that the reason that America has changed so much during the last 50 to 75 years is because of the influence of the great tax exempt foundations. And there was a congressional investigation of the great foundations back in the year 1953. And that is, of course, covered in a book we carry called Foundations, Their Power and Influence. And 55 years ago, the congressional committee, the Reese Committee that investigated the tax-exempt foundations found that the Rockefeller and Ford and Carnegie and other foundations were pushing socialism and communism and internationalism. And as Congressman Reese said, trying to destroy the love which every American has or should have for his way of life. Senator, you go right ahead. Let's see if we got a better line.
Hey, Dr. Stan.
Oh, that's wonderful. Go right ahead.
Better. Yeah, I've never had my cell phone go out that way, but I guess it's that remnants of the storm is still going through, so
right.
I'm glad we've got a better connection.
We sure do. You go right ahead.
Well, I'm not sure exactly where I was.
We were talking about how they wanted to come in with this textbook and force it into the schools. They was pushing communitarianism in the name of bring out the truth about Christianity, Bible as literature, but it wasn't Bible as literature at all. They were pushing these fascist concepts into the minds of our kids.
That's exactly what they were doing, and what I was saying was they don't leave anything to chance, and I'm convinced that they titled the book The Bible and Its Influence so they could go out to the public and say, do you support teaching the Bible and its influence in schools? In places like Alabama, South Carolina, Tennessee, places who have some Bible curriculum in their schools already, when you go out and ask the public about that, they're going to say, yes, absolutely, we support that, especially when they see the overall unraveling of the fabric of our country and the fact that so many of our morals have been lost. People are grasping for something, and they want to see that, you know, the Bible taught in schools. They want to see good moral principles taught in schools. And when this group comes out and says, hey, this is our book, it's called The Bible and Its Influence, don't you want it? So many conservative Christian leaders immediately want to go out there and put this in their schools. One of the other things they do is they go out and say, if you use our text, it is so good and it is so above reproach that we pretty much guarantee that you will not be sued. Well, I kind of laugh about that because the groups who usually do the suing are the groups pushing this agenda. So of course they're not going to sue you. It's kind of like the bully on the playground. You give me your lunch money, you won't get punched out today. And it's just so many things they do on the political side. But then when you get into the meat of the book and you start looking at who helped co-author the book and who supported the book, there's a guy named Charles Haynes who was a key player in the Bible Literacy Project. And he's the author of one of the communitarian manifestos on religious education.
But Senator, do you have a website or any telephone number you'd like to get out before we go?
Well, actually, I would like to give the telephone number for the National Council on Bible Curriculum in Public Schools.
That's right
the group
ahead.
I'm trying to help, which is hopefully we'll have a chance to talk about that before our time is up.
You're right ahead.
And I can find that number. I should have it right before me, but the difference really people ought to look at, and hopefully there's some school board members out there who are considering putting a Bible elective in their schools. You know, what I would like them to do is just look at the different curriculums out there. It doesn't have to be ours. There's a really good one from Chattanooga that's out there and available for people.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back.
Okay, thank you.
All right, Senator, go right ahead. You got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
3 minutes.
Okay.
What I would like people to do is just look at the different curriculums. Make sure that if you're going to try to put one of these Bible curriculums in your schools, that you look at one and you pick one that is going to teach the Bible, to use the Bible itself as a textbook. We're not talking about indoctrinating anyone like the Bible Literacy Project wants to do. Just teach the Bible itself and let people see what the words of the Bible are, see what the stories are, basically kind of a reading comprehension thing. The group I'm trying to help, and I think it's the best Bible curriculum in the country, is the National Council on Bible Curriculum in Public Schools, and their phone number is 336-272-2930, and the website is www.bibleinschools.net, bibleinschools.net, and you know that's for anyone who's interested in trying to get that curriculum in their local school system. It's in over 1,800 schools across the country. It's in multiple school systems. It's very inexpensive, and it really is what people think a good, solid Bible curriculum should be all about.
And, of course, the thing is, the other side hates the Bible. The last thing they want is any sort of moral standards out there. They want an amoral, immoral society, just like they had in Corinth back there in ancient Greece. And this is what so much of what the education is doing, is to destroy the moral fabric of our society.
Absolutely. I think the key goal of the other curriculum is to basically water down Christianity, water down the words of the Bible. They don't want you to look at the Bible itself. They want to tell you what to think about the Bible. They want to study the Bible from their viewpoint, where they water down Christianity, like the interfaith dialogue with Christianity and Islam and Buddhism, and everything is completely the same, and you're tolerant of each other's religions. And if they can do that, then they can start bringing about this world collectivism, which is really their overall goal.
And I think it's so very important that people understand that what is happening is not happening by accident. And behind everything is that eternal battle between God and between the people who hate the God of the Bible. And Senator Beeson, I want to thank you so very much for being with us. I really appreciate it. And hope maybe we can get you.
I appreciate you having me on. I wish we had more time. It's difficult to talk about some of these things in such a short amount of time, but I appreciate you giving me the opportunity, and I appreciate the job you do.
Well, of course, maybe we can get you on in some of our other programs. We do 5 hours a day. We'd love to get you on. You express yourself very well. And thank you for the sacrifice I know that you're making in public service, trying to utilize your platform to get the truth to the people there in Alabama. God bless, and thanks so very much for being with us.
Thank you, Dr. Stan. Have a great evening.
All right. Bye-bye. Okay, fine. Well, I hope you enjoyed our program with Seth Beeson. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and I hope you enjoyed our program with Senator Scott Beeson as we explore these communitarian concepts and understand there really are people who want to establish a dictatorship in America. If you've not yet heard our four tape or four CD set on the secret government, and then of course our talk on the secrets of the Illuminati, which is basically the Brotherhood of Darkness, just a little bit more elaborate and a little bit longer, a little better organized perhaps, or there are four tape or four CD set on secret societies. They're all available, certainly by calling 1-800-544-8927. In fact, we have a secret government special that has my talk, The Brotherhood of Darkness, and both of those tape sets and lots of other information. That's the secret government special. And we hope that you will avail yourself of that and so much of the other information we have. Sidney, how do we know this is real? Well, of course, it was a congressional investigation back in the 1950s. It was eventually shut down by the people of great wealth. The last thing they wanted was for the American people to realize that the Rockefeller Foundation was funding Alfred Kinsey's work in its effort to destroy the moral fabric of our society and encourage illicit sex and homosexuality and sex outside of marriage and to destroy the moral fabric of our society. But basically, the Reese Committee was shut down, but they uncovered a great deal of information, and this is covered in a book which we've kept in print for many years entitled Foundations, Their Power and Influence. Foundations, Their Power and Influence, one of the five most important books in my library, and it should be in your library as well. And when, of course, when the copies we have now are gone, they're gone and not going to be back in print again. And then, of course, we actually carry the book Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, written by Bill Clinton's mentor, a professor named Carol Quigley, who taught at Harvard and Princeton and until he went to Georgetown University, where he became the mentor for the man who would become the President of the United States, William Jefferson Clinton. And Professor Quigley researched the secret society that controlled Great Britain and controls the United States today. And, of course, it was a secret society behind the Royal Institute of International Affairs in Great Britain and behind the Council on Foreign Relations here in the United States. But people will never tell you that the CFR was a front organization for certainly the group known as the Roundtable Group and, for, of course, J.P. Morgan's interests, which were paramount back in the early part of this last century. 1921 is when the CFR was created. It was a front organization for Morgan and for the Roundtable, which is a front for the secret society. People say there could not be these things. Why our leaders, our politicians, somebody would tell us. No, ladies and gentlemen, they do not tell you because they don't want you to know. And that's why the book Tragedy and Hope is so important. And, of course, you can get the book Tragedy and Hope, the book Foundations, Their Power and Influence, and even an interview with Professor Quigley is the Tragedy and Hope special. Nothing like it available any other place. It will give you the information you're never going to get elsewhere at a very, very reduced price. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. Tragedy and Hope is 1,342 pages. You need to read it and reread it and read it again so that you can discuss these issues. Well, remember, Professor Quigley was totally in favor of rule by an elite. He was an elitist, and he felt you common people were incapable of looking after yourselves. And he reflected the attitude of the elitist. And you can tell that in the interview we have with him. And that's not an interview I did, but one that was done with a reporter from the Washington Post. And I purchased the right to utilize this from Professor Quigley's widow after he had passed away. We have things at Radio Liberty you're never going to hear elsewhere. My interview with Ambassador Smith on how the United States intentionally brought Fidel Castro to power, knowing he was a communist. That's in World Revolution. World Revolution, the excellent DVD. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Go to our webpage, RadioLiberty.com. You can listen to our programs 9 hours a day and watch our DVDs there for nothing. But then please pray for America. Pray for revival and pray for greater liberty for our provision.
It's a fact. Since the creation of the Federal Reserve in 1913, all banks in these United States create money out of thin air for every single loan they issue. With never-ending late fees, over-the-limit fees, and higher interest rates, it has become mathematically impossible to repay all debt, making all of us slaves to our creditors. The Federal Debt Relief System has created a successful attorney-backed program to legally eliminate credit card debt.